From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the politics of rage. Sunday, TNT begins a miniseries based on the life of George Wallace, starring Gary Sinise as Wallace. We'll hear from Dan Carter, whose Wallace biography examines the life of the four-time governor of Alabama and four-time presidential campaigner. Carter says Wallace's politics combined racism with distrust of the federal government and a nostalgia for traditional values, thus paving the way for the new conservatism that transformed American politics. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews TNT's Wallace movie and Showtime's film adaptation of Snow White, starring Sigourney Weaver. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new home video, The Art of Singing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has created an emergency board to fend off a union strike at Amtrak. The Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way employees has been seeking increased wages and had talked about striking. Mr. Clinton created the board today under the Railway Labor Act, which allows the president to act to prevent disruption of interstate commerce. The three-person emergency panel will hear the job dispute and make proposals for a new contract between Amtrak and the union. The action also imposes a 60-day cooling-off period. This will give more time for negotiation, but also allows congressional intervention if no settlement is reached. Two people are dead, two others injured, after a head-on collision between a runaway train and a freight train in Fort Worth, Texas. From member station KERA in Dallas, Bill Siebel reports.
An outbound Union Pacific train with four crewmen aboard collided with an unmanned quartet of engines rolling inbound from nearby Weatherford. The wreck threw up a fireball just before midnight last night and spilled 3,000 gallons of gooey diesel fuel on site in West Fort Worth. Officials don't know how or why the inbound engines were loose on the same rails with the El Paso-bound freight train pulling about 100 cars. In addition to the two deaths, one of the remaining two injured men is now in the hospital. The other isn't seriously injured. Union Pacific officials are headed into Fort Worth from their Omaha, Nebraska headquarters. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Siebel in Dallas.
The chief executive officer of tobacco maker Philip Morris says it's possible about 100,000 Americans might have died from smoking-related diseases. CEO Jeffrey Bible's remark to Florida state attorneys is much more than tobacco executives have volunteered to date, with the exception of Liggett Company. Bible's comments came at the end of a deposition taken by the Florida lawyers. The crew of the space station Mir is taking it easy today, resting up for a difficult spacewalk tomorrow. From Moscow, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Russian cosmonauts Anatoly Solovyov and Pavel Vinogradov will try to fix Mir's most pressing problem since the June 25th accident that left it disabled. They'll try to restore the electricity that used to come from the Spectre science module, which is now sealed off. The two cosmonauts will put on spacesuits and then depressurize the part of Mir leading to Spectre. Using flashlights to peer into the airless and freezing module, they'll then try to reconnect cables leading to Spectre's solar batteries. The work will be tricky, especially since no one knows what's floating around inside the module. But officials describe this mission as less difficult than other previous space repair jobs, including the American mission to fix the Hubble Space Telescope. American astronaut Michael Full will sit in Mir's escape capsule throughout the repair mission, which could take between 4 and 7 hours. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 52 points at 7,969. The Nasdaq is off 6.5 points at 1,622. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower for the first time this week. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Analysts say the market is consolidating its recent gains. In the first 3 days of the week, the Dow rose 327 points. The most active issue is MCI Communications, which has fallen 13%. MCI and British Telecom are renegotiating the terms of BT's $23.7 billion purchase of MCI. This follows MCI's disclosure that its local phone business will lose $800 million this year. Overnight, the company said there is no assurance of an outcome. The stock market is being adversely affected by rising long-term interest rates, which are higher on word that regional manufacturing in the Philadelphia area was not as weak as expected. I'm Doug Krisner.
A California state board has reversed a decision to suspend Chrysler's license to do business in the state. The suspension was originally a punishment for the automaker for repeatedly violating the state's lemon law on bad cars. The original decision was seen as a victory for consumers and could have cost Chrysler more than $14 million. But the California New Motor Vehicle Board has ruled it would also cost 240 Chrysler dealerships about $60,000 each, even though the dealers weren't accused of wrongdoing. One local United Parcel Service union is still on strike. Members of Teamsters Local 705 in Chicago say they're making progress in their separate contract negotiations with the company. The Teamsters and UPS agreed earlier on a tentative contract this week. The Teamsters had struck the company for 15 days. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new two-part miniseries based on the life of George Wallace begins this Sunday on TNT with Gary Sinise as Wallace. The movie takes liberties with the story by adding fictional characters and scenes. We're going to hear about Wallace's life from Dan Carter, the author of a 1996 biography called The Politics of Rage. At the peak of the civil rights era in the early 60s, Alabama Governor George Wallace built his career on opposing integration. Carter writes that Wallace also laid the foundation for the conservative counter-revolution of the 70s and 80s. His approach combined fears about race and communism with anti-Washington feelings, cultural nostalgia, and conservative economics. Wallace served four terms as governor of Alabama, beginning in 1963, and he campaigned for the presidency four times. An assassination attempt during his final run left him paralyzed. Now in his late 70s, he's deaf, bedridden, and living in Montgomery. Dan Carter is a professor of history at Emory University and the author of a previous book on the Scottsboro Boys. I spoke with Carter last year when The Politics of Rage was published. He told me that Wallace anticipated the themes of the conservative groundswell which began in the 70s.
If you look at the issues that made Wallace a national figure, you begin with race, of course, but the fact is after the 1964, Wallace may have used coded language to talk about race, but those weren't his main themes. His main themes were the disintegration of American culture and values, although he would never have used those words. He talked about the way in which Americans were under siege, and he put his finger on that growing sense of unease that I think reaches its culmination in the 80s and 90s, in which middle-class, working-class Americans feel like the country's off track. And Wallace is not, I mean, what he does is he finds those issues, those social issues, as they came to be called, that excite the electorate in a way that they become the themes of the politics of the late 60s, 70s, and into the 80s.
Well, I think it would be interesting to have you read a couple of excerpts of his inaugural speech, the first time he was elected governor of Alabama. And which year is this?
This is 1963. He's January 1963. He's elected the previous year. He's now taking office.
Read an excerpt of that address for us.
It begins not with the reference specifically to race that comes and that everyone remembers from the inaugural address. It begins with a general kind of discussion about the role of the White South, or the South, and he associated the White South with the South, as a besieged region. And let me just read here a short section. There were no government handouts after the Civil War, no Marshall Plan aid, no coddling to make sure that our people would not suffer. Instead, the South was set upon by the vulturous carpetbagger and federal troops. There was no money, no food, no hope of either. But our grandfathers bent their knee only in church and bowed their head only to God.
What's the significance of his reference there to federal troops? What's he referring to?
Well, he's referring to the post-Civil War period when, for a brief period of time, during the so-called Reconstruction period after the American Civil War, federal troops were stationed in the South to protect the right of the emancipated slave to vote and to prevent a kind of violent counter-revolution by white Southerners. But, of course, it assumes a kind of mythology by the end of the 19th and early 20th century in which white Southerners, I mean, in a sense, they're the ultimate victims in American society. At least they see themselves as such. They've been oppressed. They've been oppressed by the federal government during the Reconstruction, and they see this long tradition of outsiders, even before the Civil War, abolitionists, Yankees, who are trying to change their way of life.
But that theme is even continuing into the Civil Rights Movement, and I think he's referring to that, too.
Absolutely. And he sees this having a kind of historical tradition. And I should say, he sees this. He's actually reading here a speech, of course, which was written by his speechwriter, a man named Asa Carter, who was a Ku Klux Klan organizer and a rather brilliant polemicist for the segregationist South. But he agreed with it, even though the words weren't his own. He certainly agreed with them.
So when Wallace starts ringing this theme of, you know, we only bow our heads to God and church and, you know, not to the federal troops that the government sends down, what's he referring to in the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, of course, he's talking about the increasing importance of the role of the federal government, first the courts and then tentatively in the Kennedy administration, then even more so in the Johnson administration, the commitment of the national government to protecting the rights of black citizens in the South. To him and to many white Southerners, it's simply one more in the long train of these actions by the federal government that that are attempting to change our Southern way of life, as it would have been called, the 1940s and 1950s. And it has a clear racial context, as he's speaking in 1963.
I'm going to ask you to read another excerpt of that 1963 inaugural address, which contains an excerpt that contains the most famous line from that address.
Well, in fact, it's the only line. This is the only line that George Wallace, that he uttered, that ends up in Bartlett's familiar quotations. I'm not sure that's the one he would have preferred, but here it is. After talking about the way in which the white South, he says, has been oppressed, or the South, which he always identifies with the white South, he issues what he calls his call to arms. Today I have stood where once Jefferson Davis stood and took an oath to my people. It is very appropriate, then, that from this cradle of the Confederacy, this very heart of the great Anglo-Saxon Southland, we sound the drum for freedom. In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
And that segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, that's the phrase that made it into Bartlett's.
That's it. And it in effect, amounts to a kind of Faustian bargain for Wallace, because he's now at the very beginning of his career. He's so closely and intimately associated himself with the defense of segregation, racism, that he'll never be able to completely get rid of that that albatross around his neck. But he eventually does, because he does broaden. Originally, his attacks on the federal government were dismissed by individuals, by most observers, commentators, as simply a reflection of this white Southern paranoia in the South. And the genius of Wallace is that he manages to break out of that mold that has kept white Southern segregationist politicians like Orville Faubus and Ross Barnett and Strom Thurmond and others in a kind of exclusive Southern box, so that by the time he moves into these campaigns for the presidency in 64 and 68 and 72 and 76, the overtones, the racial overtones are still there, but he takes that Southern racial stand against the federal government and broadens it and makes it much more than just a racial issue.
What does he make it into?
Well, he makes it in, he convinces, he had no trouble convincing white Southerners in 1963 that the federal government was their enemy, or at least most white Southerners who saw, didn't want to change race relations in the South, the federal government was trying to change them, it was their enemy. But what he succeeds in doing, and it takes years of constant agitation, if you will, he develops a kind of ear for the way in which other Americans, not just white Southerners, see the federal government as their enemy. He begins with race. But think about the things that happened during the 1960s. The sense of social dislocation, the rise in crime, the turmoil in the streets that come with the anti-war movement, the way in which Americans sense that they've lost their moral bearings, rise of pornography, the Supreme Court decisions outlawing school prayer. All of these things, Wallace very, very astutely blames upon the federal government. If we're having a rise in crime, it's because you've got federal judges, the Supreme Court and other federal judges, who are essentially turning criminals loose on the street. If you've got a problem of a loss of moral bearings in American society, it's because we've banned God from the classroom. And who is it that have done these things? It's the institutions, courts, the president, even the Congress, who have committed these crimes against the American people.
Is there anything new about this theme when Wallace starts playing it?
It's not so much new. I mean, you can find echoes of both the style and the issues. And in some ways, it's a very traditional kind of paranoid anti-intellectualism that Richard Hofstadter talked about 40, 50 years ago, a style that you see in American politics going back into the 19th century. But what Wallace anticipates as early as the early 1960s, I mean, think about it. This is the heyday of the civil rights movement, the heyday of American liberalism. The election of 1964 seems to be a referendum in which Lyndon Johnson has captured the crest of this wave of liberalism that is finally triumphant, that is a kind of culmination of everything that's taken place in American politics since the 1930s. And what Wallace senses, as early as 63 and 64, is that it's more than just a handful of cranks, more than just a bunch of white segregationists who are uneasy, resistant to the triumphal federal state. And he senses that because he has this kind of sixth sense about politics. And he begins hammering away at these anti-federal themes. And gradually he moves away from this very narrow Southern base and moves, in fact, rather quickly, I think, into a national constituency.
Actually, that's another theme of your book, that when he moves away from the politics of race and talks about other issues that he feels affect a lot of other people in the South, that he changes the role of the South in American politics.
Well, it would be too much to say that George Wallace is responsible for the Southernization of American politics, as one writer called it. But he clearly, despite his own limitations, and he had serious limitations as a national communicator, particularly in the age of television. Nevertheless, he does succeed in as I said, ending the kind of isolation of the political voice of the South, the conservative political voice of the South. In the election, the presidential campaigns of 64 and 68, particularly 1968, I think, there's a kind of, seems a kind of frivolous kind of issue, but as late as 1968, when Richard Nixon and Hubert, running as a Republican candidate, Hubert Humphrey's a Democrat, and Wallace is the independent third-party candidate, Nixon was extremely reluctant to do anything that might be seen as appealing to the Wallace constituency, at least overtly. Even in matters of style, this, as I said, Terry, this sounds trivial, but some of his aides who were more familiar with what was happening in America, for example, wanted them to use country music jingles, wanted them to use these in his campaigns. And Nixon's advisors said, no, this is not dignified. Well, when Wallace captured 15% of the vote, and at one time he had almost about 25% of the American people who said they were going to vote for him, that all of a sudden it may not have been dignified anymore, but it became more mainstream. That is, in the sense, the Southern aspects of Wallace that seemed to mark him outside the mainstream, more and more make him part of that central flow of American politics.
How did George Wallace use religion in his political campaigns?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in his actual campaigns himself, a lot of secular reporters and news people who covered him sort of tried not to laugh as they were describing it, but it seemed so 1920s. It just didn't seem very modern and up to date. All his campaign rallies would begin with "God Bless America" and some patriotic songs, and then a prayer, often a very long and impassioned evangelical prayer. And when he started this in the 1960s, particularly in some of his tours around the West Coast and the Upper Midwest and the Northeast, it seemed so Southern and so out of step with modern American society. Well, in many ways, of course, Wallace's campaigns, what he was picking up on was the resurgence, which was going on and almost undetected by the news media, of the rise of a conservative religious right, which was taking place before our eyes. We just didn't see it in the 1960s.
My guest is Dan Carter, author of a biography of George Wallace called The Politics of Rage. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dan Carter, author of a biography of George Wallace. Now, Wallace is most famous for being a racist, but you say that he didn't start his political career on race issues.
No, and one of the, I understand that everyone's interested in the long-term implications of Wallace, and I am too. But when I tried to write this book, I was also trying to write about a time and a place which was not our own. And Wallace grew up in that that time and place, the Deep South of the 1920s and 1930s. And in a sense, it's not our own time. You can't exactly compare it in terms of racial attitudes or anything else. But it's clear that by the standards of the 1930s and the 1940s, George Wallace was a moderate. One might even call him a moderate liberal on race. Probably the most influential political figure in his career was Big Jim Folsom of Alabama, a kind of almost a unique figure in Southern politics who avoided racism and in fact, treated his black constituents fairly and refused to use racism. That was the early Wallace, not the one that we came to know.
What changed him?
Well, it's ambition. George Wallace had certain feelings about. He didn't feel, he wasn't strongly racist, perhaps, but the thing that he really wanted was power. He used to say this to his members of his family, that he was, there were only two things important in life, money and power. He was never going to have money, but he was going to have power. And that meant that in the late 1950s, when he made his first campaign for the governorship in Alabama, he encountered the fact the dilemma that in order to be elected, you had to be an extremist on race. There were no black voters in Alabama. Emotions were inflamed after Little Rock, and the race issue was foremost. He tried to be a moderate in 1958, and he lost. He lost to a hardline segregationist named John Patterson. And when he did, that was it. He did an about-face, or at least, if not 180 degrees, about 90 degrees, and embraced the politics of race.
Excuse my language here, but what he said after he lost to Patterson was, "No one will ever out-nigger me again."
That was his, the night that he lost, when he was extremely bitter over what he felt like was Patterson's successful use of the race issue, and yes, that's what he told his friends. And he later denied that he had made this statement, but at least one individual who was there that night insists that he was emphatic, and this is what he said, Star Smith, who was a newsman at the time. And in the years that followed, he said essentially the same thing to other people, that, like it or not, that you were going to have to play the race issue.
Of course, a lot of the civil rights struggles were played out in Alabama. I think the most famous image of George Wallace is when he stood in the doorway at the University of Alabama in an attempt to prevent the university's desegregation. And of course, the federal government was insisting that African-American students be allowed to attend. Tell us a little bit about his, what you know of his thinking behind that move.
I've sometimes quoted the proverb, supposedly it's a Middle Eastern proverb, that a man is made powerful by having powerful enemies. And in 1963, George Wallace understood that John Kennedy and the Kennedy administration was well on its way to being the most hated president in the White South that, since the days of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And so he courted a confrontation with the Kennedy administration and went out of his way to set it up. I don't think George Wallace ever had any illusions in the back of his mind. He knew that he was going to have to back down. But he wanted to set it up so that he could become the defender of the White South, the defender of traditional values at that point of the White South, that is, the defense of segregation. And so and I have a great deal of sympathy for the Kennedy administration, but he played the Kennedy administration like a superb angler, keeping him on the hook at all times, never letting them know what he was going to do, holding out at least the threat of violence, which had occurred the previous year when the administration tried to integrate the University of Mississippi. And as a result, he was essentially able to lay out the groundwork for a kind of a confrontation. It was a mock confrontation. I think it's wonderful that it ends up in Forrest Gump's film Forrest Gump, because that's what it really was, a kind of theatrical confrontation. But it did succeed. It did succeed in placing, as you say, Wallace into this position where there is this very vivid image of him standing up to the Assistant Attorney General of the United States, Nicholas Katzenbach, and through Katzenbach with the Kennedy administration. And from that moment on, as I said, that's part of the albatross of race is going to be around his neck later on, but it gives him extraordinary kind of national attention and a national reputation. One of the most interesting things about that stand in the schoolhouse door was the fact, and I think this even surprised George Wallace, was the outpouring of letters, financial contributions, which began pouring in, not from the South, which he anticipated, but from all over the country. And that's when he really began to grasp the extent of the racial white backlash that was taking place. And the extent to which there was a national constituency for his racial ideas and later his other ideas as well.
Dan Carter's biography of George Wallace is called The Politics of Rage. We'll hear more from Carter in the second half of our show. Gary Sinise will star as George Wallace in a TNT miniseries that begins Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Dan Carter about the impact of George Wallace on American politics. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews TNT's movie, George Wallace, that begins Sunday. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new home video that showcases some of opera's greatest singers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview about George Wallace, the four-time governor of Alabama and four-time presidential hopeful. This Sunday, TNT begins a two-part movie biography of Wallace starring Gary Sinise. Dan Carter is the author of a biography of Wallace called The Politics of Rage, in which he traces how Wallace set the stage for the new conservatism that transformed American politics. Wallace built his early career on his opposition to integration in the 60s. Our interview was recorded last year when the biography was published. What was George Wallace's approach to dealing with civil rights demonstrators?
Well, in the early 1960s, it was leave no heads uncracked. From the very beginning of his administration, I think it shows. I've tried to be fair to the life of George Wallace and to treat it as a whole, but I think the particular 1963, 64, and 65, you can see Governor Wallace at his most reckless. In terms of the appointments he makes, Al Lingo, I won't say a homicidal, but certainly a psychologically unstable man appointed to be head of the state troops, so-called state troopers. His support for people like Bull Connor in Birmingham, his close associations, as I describe in the book, despite his attempt to cover them up, his close associations with members of the Ku Klux Klan, with a Nazi group that he used, manipulated. He never let them control him, but he used them, cooperated with them in a way that even considering the passions of the 1960s, it's a pretty dark story, I think.
George Wallace made several runs for the presidency. And during those runs, he insisted he wasn't a racist, which was, I think, pretty difficult to insist given his record. How did he change his position and change his rhetoric?
Well, he changed his rhetoric before he changed his position. In the campaign of 1964, he ran in the Democratic primaries against stand-ins for Lyndon Johnson. And his only real issue in 1964 was the pending Civil Rights Act that had been proposed by Kennedy and was pushed through by Johnson. But he never used the word, never used the N-word, certainly, and he never even talked explicitly about race. He learned very early on that you could use code words. You could use coded language to talk about race without actually appearing to talk about race.
What was his code?
His code was the sanctity of the neighborhood, the sanctity of your union seniority rights. At any point that the federal government, the autonomy of local communities, so that, for example, when the federal government is trying to do something about the blatant discrimination, voting discrimination, that takes place in the South, he says that, that traditionally under the doctrine of states' rights, the states have a right to decide voting requirements, and this is none of the federal government's business. You got a case after case involving civil rights workers in which white juries, all-white juries, whipped up by the passion of the time, acquit men who are clearly guilty of mayhem and murder. And when individuals throughout the country react with righteous indignation, then he treats it as an attack upon the jury system. In other words, never mention the word race, but talk about issues in a and actually talk about them in a context with which most Americans agree. That is, most people do celebrate the importance of community and family and local institutions. There's a long tradition of this. But in at least in the early stages, no one had, I don't think most people had any illusions about what he was really talking about. When he talked about the right of local self-government, he was talking about the right of local self-government to oppress black people.
Do you think that he believed he would ever get elected president?
No. I mean, he may have in a moment of fantasy, but I think toward the end of his political career, and talking to some of his friends, he confided that he had always been born, as he said, at the wrong time. And there was a certain truth about that. Jimmy Carter, in some ways, was lucky to have come along a little bit later, a Southerner who wasn't caught up in all the passions of the 50s, in the same way that George Wallace. He did things, said things that that meant he would never be elected president. And I think George Wallace was smart enough to understand that.
So you think that Wallace, through his coded language, was able to exploit the fears of some Northerners as well as Southerners?
Yes.
Who do you think benefited from those inroads that he made?
Well, Wallace's, I don't want to, I always try to back off. Anyone who does a biography thinks their biographical subject is the most important figure since Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And I'm not trying to argue that, but Wallace, more than any other single political figure in the 1960s, was the one who played a critical role in breaking loose important parts of the old Democratic coalition, particularly working class whites, young white males. The so-called Reagan Democrats of the 1980s are the Wallace Democrats, who first turned and supported Wallace in 1968 and 72, and then tended to go toward Richard Nixon early on, and then finally come home to Ronald Reagan. I mean, if you look at the contour of the Wallace vote among independent voters in 1968, you find an interesting kind of profile. They tend to be young, male individuals who were probably leaning toward the Democratic Party but saw themselves as independents, a new generation of voters who were not tied in the same way that their parents were. Well, this was exactly the group that Kevin Phillips and other Republican strategists saw in the 1960s as essential to recovering from the Goldwater debacle of 1964. We've got to get these people in the Republican Party. And Wallace was the figure who, in a sense, cut them loose from the Democratic Party, aroused their anger toward the Democratic Party. After the election of 1968, there was a cottage industry of Republican strategists, led by Kevin Phillips, but included others as well, who looked at the Wallace vote, analyzed and reanalyzed it, and saw it as the key to unlocking this 35-year-old Democratic majority.
In 1972, Wallace was shot 3 times by Arthur Bremer. Wallace survived, although he was paralyzed from the waist down. Why was Wallace the target?
Well, it's Governor Wallace himself and many of his former advisors. I just talked to one within the last on the telephone within the last few months. Believe that there was someone in the Nixon administration who set up Arthur Bremer, either persuaded him to do the shooting or in some way encouraged it. I guess conspiracy theories flow everywhere. And it was something, I certainly didn't begin with that assumption, but it was something I wanted to keep an open mind about when I started the research. And I was very fortunate because of a third party to locate the large missing section of Arthur Bremer's diary. He had a secret diary he kept, parts of which were recovered after the shooting, but the critical first parts were not. In some ways, I guess it had made a bestseller if I could have proved that there was a secret hand of Richard Nixon or his administration behind it. But in fact, Arthur Bremer was a classic American political assassin, someone who is estranged from society, deeply mentally ill is the best way to describe him, who is interested not in politics. He doesn't. His first target was Richard Nixon. He wanted to shoot Richard Nixon. He mainly wants to make a place for himself in American society, and the only way he knows to do that is to shoot a political figure. He's not the first one to, as we know, to fit that profile.
I think a lot of biographers fall in love with their subjects. What do you feel emotionally toward your subject, George Wallace?
I didn't fall in love with George Wallace. I think a certain sadness. I do feel, and I share, I grew up in the deep rural South, and even though I rejected the kind of racial attitudes that George Wallace had, I can empathize with his sense that of alienation, his sense that white Southerners, and they really do share more than they realize, I think, with black Southerners and other marginal groups in American society, being on the outside. So in that sense, I have a kind of empathy for George Wallace. And I have a sadness that someone so capable, so intelligent, so with such drive and such ambition should in the end allow his that ambition to lead him to do, it sounds so preacherish, but such horrible things for which I think he is living with the consequences of today. So in the sense, it's a kind of sadness about someone like Wallace.
Did you meet George Wallace ever?
Many years ago, but not when I was working on the book.
And was it a significant meeting?
No, not at all. I heard him speak twice. And now that was actually more important in terms of my longtime fascination with Wallace. I heard him speak in 1964 when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, and I saw him come there to a hostile liberal student body and show a side of George Wallace that I also talk about in the book, and that's a very charming side of George Wallace. They came to scoff and stayed to pray, but by the end of the hour, he had them, at least the majority of them, laughing in his and kind of liking him. Then I heard him again in 1968 in Maryland, and listening to him, watching him, was what actually led to this longtime fascination with him.
What did he say on the college campus that turned some of the listeners around?
Well, he, in the first place, I think he had the enormous advantage that, in particularly in 1964, that the students really expected a kind of monster. You know, most people didn't read that closely, and they thought he was going to get up and talk, use racist language, as Ross Barnett had been there 2 weeks before. And he was this pathetic figure out of the 19th century talking about the Negro's this and the Negro's that, and people began laughing at him. Well, Wallace got up, and even though the students may have thought that it was simply a kind of facade, he gave actually a pretty thoughtful kind of talk about the constitutional issues involved in expanding the power of the federal government. And then when the question and answer period came, and people would shout these hostile, angry questions, he had a whole series of one-liners. People would heckle him. He had a whole series of one-liners that he had developed over the years, which he would give in this ingratiating kind of "I'm just a not terribly bright country boy from Alabama" kind of way, that kind of won over his audience by the end of the time.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Dan Carter's biography of George Wallace is called The Politics of Rage. Our interview was recorded last year after the book's publication. Gary Sinise will star as Wallace in a two-part telemovie that begins Sunday evening on TNT. David Bianculli has a review. After a break, this is Fresh Air. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of this weekend's two most interesting new offerings, and he isn't surprised that they're both on cable.
Do you know how long it's been since one of the broadcast networks presented anything outside of sports or news that was worth watching? I do, because I just looked it up. It was 3 months ago, at the end of May, when NBC showed The Birth of the Baby on Mad About You, and ABC burned off its final episodes of Murder One. Since then, the only things shown on broadcast TV, other than reruns of news magazines, have been fresh episodes of ABC's Spy Game, which the network already had canceled, and Fox shows like The Ruby Wax Show and Roar, which were just as doomed. It wasn't always this way. Seinfeld started as a summer series, and so did Northern Exposure. And not too many summers ago, viewers could turn to the networks and watch original episodes of Due South and TV Nation. Intelligent, entertaining shows. But now we get squat, and the networks wonder why their audience base continues to erode. Over on cable, though, summer is a major season. We've got the intense drama series Oz on HBO and the outrageous South Park adult cartoon on Comedy Central. And in the last 2 months, while the broadcast networks have been hibernating, cable has given us some truly outstanding telemovies. The docudrama Hostile Waters, the docu-comedy Elvis Meets Nixon, and a remake of the Golden Age TV drama 12 Angry Men. Sunday night, two more quality efforts join that bunch. TNT presents a four-hour miniseries biography called George Wallace, with Gary Sinise in the title role. And Showtime gives us a mature and scary spin on a classic fairy tale with Snow White, A Tale of Terror, starring Sigourney Weaver as the wicked stepmother. Sinise, who already played Harry Truman for another cable biography, is excellent as George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama. And so are the acting and direction across the board. However, the drama has two drawbacks. It's a bit cavalier with distinguishing between fact and fiction. It even presents a hypothetical murder attempt on Wallace's life by a made-up character. And the music is so overblown that it threatens to destroy the mood even as Sinise creates it. As in this speech scene, where Wallace makes clear his racist intentions as a politician.
From this cradle of the Confederacy, this very heart of the great Anglo-Saxon Southland, today we sound the drum of freedom. Let us rise to the call of the freedom-loving blood that is in us. In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Snow White has no such flaws, but just as good a performance. Sigourney Weaver plays her part not as a camp Cruella de Vil, but more like a tragic figure from Shakespeare. This is the Brothers Grimm at its most grim. And when this wicked stepmother looks in the mirror, she sees and talks to a lovelier version of herself, making her seem as much delusional as magical.
Why does she live? While your child lies cold and still.
What?
Take back the child and give him life.
How?
Steal the father's seed. Bathe the child in the father's blood.
Friedrich's life. For his.
George Wallace is the more serious topic, and Snow White is the better overall drama. But either of them beats anything the networks are showing these days. And that's the point, even though it's a point the networks just don't seem to get.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Lord Schwartz reviews the video The Art of Singing. This is Fresh Air. There's a new home video in the stores that music critic Lord Schwartz thinks every opera lover will want to see. It's called The Art of Singing, Golden Voices of the Century, and includes film clips and kinescopes of many of this century's greatest singers. Here's Lord's review.
Ridere vuole qua, se arlecchino, utir volo colombino. sbagliato e ognuno s'applaudirà.
Enrico Caruso died before sound came to film, but the tenor was so popular he actually made a silent movie. So now, in this new home video, The Art of Singing, you can also see him in Pagliacci. There's also a poignant vignette filmed in 1932 of the Italian coloratura Luisa Tetrazzini, after whom Chicken Tetrazzini was named. She was then 61 and well past her vocal prime. We watch her listening to a phonograph recording of her old partner, Caruso, and she begins to sing along with him. This video cornucopia shows us what many of the greatest opera singers looked like when they sang, or at least lip-synced. Metropolitan Opera mezzo-soprano Risa Stevens talks about how in the movie of The Chocolate Soldier, after she recorded her music, MGM made her sing an octave lower when she did the synchronization so that her face would appear less distorted. There are some interesting cross-references. Fyodor Shalyapin, the great Russian basso, whose most famous role is Boris Godunov, sings a Jacques Ibert song from a 1933 French movie version of Don Quixote, directed by G.W. Pabst. Later, Ezio Pinza, who's probably best known for singing Some Enchanted Evening in the original Broadway production of South Pacific, is shown in a clip from the movie Deep in My Heart, in which he plays Shalyapin, singing the coronation scene from Boris. One standout is the brilliant Spanish coloratura mezzo-soprano Conchita Supervia, who plays a glamorous opera singer named Baba L'Etoile in a British film called Evensong. She sings Musetta's waltz, and her face is as captivating and animated as her voice. Another remarkable selection is the screen test that the great Italian-American soprano Rosa Poncel did for MGM. As Carmen, a role she'd sung at the Met, she looks like a movie star. I guess MGM didn't think so. Her spoken comments afterwards are also delightful.
Right now, Carmen, of course.
Why do you like Carmen better than me?
Oh, I suppose because she's a barbaric and I love to be wild, where I can hold a stiletto between my teeth and let you have it when you deserve it.
There are 27 opera stars in all on this video. Some of them, like baritone Giuseppe De Luca, who sings Figaro in a 1929 Vitaphone short, and Lawrence Tibbett, a dashing toreador, are surprisingly vivid actors. Some hardly act at all, like tenors Tito Skipa or Beniamino Gigli, or Leontine Price as Aida, or Renata Tibaldi and Jussi Björling, who are shown in a rare TV appearance. They're introduced by Charles Laughton. They're embarrassingly mature for Puccini's reckless young lovers in La Bohème, yet their voices carry all the conviction they need. Maria Callas aficionados will want to see the two brief, recently discovered clips from her famous Lisbon Traviata. Unfortunately, you can barely make out her face, but even a glimpse of her slumping posture says a lot about how she acted what some people think was her greatest role. And it's part of a good sequence in which conductor Nicola Rescigno talks about her attitude toward this role.
I remember once, we were, I think it's Covent Garden, we were doing Traviata, and at the end of A Forse Lui, she would attack this note very soft, and she'd crack it every night. And I'd go backstage, and I'd say, oh, Maria, come on, attack it a little bit louder, more forte, And then when you have the note, then you can diminish it and get your effect. And this kept going night after night after night. And I said, finally I said, well, you know, you're a Greek. And no use talking to you. She said, Nicola, I won't compromise. I'll crack every night, but I'm dying. And that's the way it's going to be.
This partly frustrating find is followed by what's arguably the most powerful operatic performance on film, Callas in the second act of Tosca with Tito Gobbi as Scarpia, filmed live at Covent Garden in 1964. If you already know opera, you'll be thrilled with what's likely to be a first look at some of these singers. If you don't, this is a good way to hear and see some of the past greats.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new home video called The Art of Singing, Golden Voices of the Century, on the NVC Arts label. Well, we have a couple of special things coming up that I want to let you know about. Next week, we close out the summer season with a full week of comedy, and you'll need a good laugh before facing all the work that September is bound to bring. Our comedy week will feature interviews with stand-ups, actors, and writers. And we also just recorded an interview with Sam Phillips that we expect to broadcast during the first week of September. Sam Phillips is the record producer who founded Sun Records in Memphis and discovered Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Charlie Rich, B.B. King, and Howlin' Wolf. He's had an extraordinary impact on popular music. We'll end today's show with one of Sam Phillips' recordings of Elvis on Sun Records. I'm Terry Gross.
I've been traveling over miles, even through the valleys too. I've been traveling in day, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Ever since I read your letter, where you said you loved me true, I've been traveling night and day, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. When I read your loving letter, then my heart began to sing. There were many miles between us, but it didn't mean a thing. I just had to reach you, baby, kept traveling night and day, I kept running all the way, baby, trying to get to you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, country music star George Jones. And we hear from former Senator George McGovern. His memoir about his daughter's alcoholism, which led to her death, is out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.